The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Now, the big news of the day, I guess, is impeachment. Last time I was on the show, I think it was the last time, it was the day the transcripts with Mr. Trump's Ukraine call were published. Now I'm up the day after the impeachment vote. I don't know why I keep getting these big US news days. I'll talk about it for a little bit, but not too much. We've hit that a lot on the show, and at least if judging by one of our sound clips that we'll play today, most of you in America are fed up of hearing about this subject anyway. But as I mentioned, the House of Representatives voted yesterday to impeach Mr. Trump. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing the results of that vote.
On this vote, the yeas are 230. The nays are 197. Present is one. Article 1 is adopted. This vote, the yeas are 229. The nays are 198. Present is one. Article 2 is adopted.
Now, if you're watching that on the video stream, you can see, especially after that first impeachment announcement, you know, people start to cheer, and then Ms. Pelosi gives them a gives them a bit of a look, a very teacher-like look. I guess this is meant to be a solemn and sober ceremony. She announced in the morning, you know, that they were, how sad they were to be doing this, that they're not at all happy, and it kind of ruins that a bit when a bunch of the people in the House of Representatives start cheering, and there are reports, I guess, of parties and things like that. But Victor Davis Hanson had a very good article on this impeachment, and he just talked about how, he said the prior subtext to impeachment, if not smeared or stopped, Trump will win in 2020, was spoken only by hardcore leftists. Now it is voiced shamelessly by leaders in the party, such as Gerald Nadler, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Rep. Adam Schiff, with the twist of fear that Mr. Trump will rig the election. After special counsel Robert Mueller, of course, found he had not done so in 2016, and Horowitz found that the Trump's campaign aides were largely targeted by the FBI and CRA hierarchy unless he is impeached. Kind of, I guess, an awkward phrasing to read out loud, but he's just talking about the way U.S. Democrats have been saying, and more senior Democrats have been saying, well, we've got to impeach Mr. Trump, because if we don't, then he's going to win the election. Except they've been alleging without any evidence that if they don't impeach him, he will rig the election. But he writes that the legacy of Schiff and Nadler is to completely discredit impeachment itself. It will now become passé as a common rank tool of the opposition majority party in the House to undermine a first-term president on the eve of his re-election bid. And he talks about how this could just, it's setting a dangerous precedent, how it's become simply a tool to banish a leader, whether he be prominent, successful, or merely an object of envy and hate. He writes, every impeachment charge against Trump, or Mr. Trump, far more easily could have been lodged against an imperial Obama presidency, without mentioning that Mr. Obama ultimately may be found to be knowledgeable of the entire CIA, FBI, and Justice Department surveilling of an opposition campaign and sabotage of a presidential transition. In sum, the Democrat boomerang on impeachment will make Harry Reid's reverse torpedo on the filibuster look minor. And Andy McCarthy had a similar point in the New York Post. He wrote that Trump's impeachment is all too likely to become the new normal. That was the title of his article. And he talked about how it's the one the framers of America's Constitution feared, a straight party line, impeachment on fairly nebulous charges. He writes, the new standard is so amorphous it could be applied to any president. Every president, after all, abuses the awesome powers of the office from time to time, and the opposition party always cries corruption. Now, there's talk, I think, of Nancy Pelosi not passing the article of impeachment onto the Senate so that the Senate can conduct the trial, which is something unprecedented, and I didn't even realize that was a possibility. The idea is that if they refuse to pass this on to the Senate, well, then the Senate can't get on with the trial. The Senate, just even if you just look at the numbers, if it's another party line vote, the Senate will vote to acquit Mr. Trump. And then he can go into the election saying, well, yes, I was impeached, but I was acquitted. The talk behind this theory of holding it off is so that Mr. Trump can't say that he was acquitted just because it was never allowed forward to go to trial, which just undermines the whole purpose of impeachment. I mean, the whole idea of impeaching a president is to get rid of a law-breaking or corrupt or, you know, a president that's guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. If you impeach them but then don't let that move forward, well, what's the point? You might as well just pass a motion of censure then. Anyway, it may not happen this way. The Boston Globe noted that trying to do it this way would infuriate House members from competitive districts who have pushed Pelosi for months to keep the investigation focused and limited to Mr. Trump's Ukraine conduct. So that's where we are now. We'll have to see where we go forwards. We've got one final clip on this subject. Sam spotted this yesterday, and I thought it was interesting. This is from Eddie Mayer's PM program on Radio 4. And you know, he wanted to ask the question, well, we know what Washington thinks about impeachment and what the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, what do those outside the Washington bubble say about impeachment? And I think it's an interesting look at how impeachment looks from, say, the UK and from overseas as well. But he interviewed a radio host from Burlington, Iowa, named Fred Hoffman. And I thought the exchange was pretty interesting. Here's the start of that interview.
What was your show about this morning? You've just come off air. Was it all about the impeachment?
It was not all about the impeachment. In fact, I'm trying to think if it came. It came up in the news segments. But in terms of the calls and everything, it's not been about the impeachment very often at all for the last couple of weeks.
Why are we talking about the impeachment on our radio show if you're not talking about it on your one and you're American citizens?
Well, when the whole thing started, of course, it was the news in the very beginning with the very first hearings and what have you. And from that point on, like an onion peeling away, it was revealed to us to be not a very serious thing, not a very anything but a political stunt, really. And so people became less and less interested in it as the Democrat part of the party did not produce all of this evidence for all the allegations, and people just became disinterested in it.
Would you say your callers have just written this off as Washington politics, no more, no less?
Exactly, which is tiring as it wears over the months.
So just an interesting take there. Well, why are we talking about this over in the UK and you're not even talking about it in the US? It's also, you know, you don't often hear anything even remotely pro Mr. Trump on the BBC. So that amused me anyway, that exchange there. But it will be interesting. I think it will be most interesting, though, to see how this plays out in the Senate. I think that's the point that this whole impeachment scandal is going to stop becoming kind of the same old partisan attacks. You know, as we pointed out before, you could really get, when people are summoned to the Senate as witnesses and have to testify and things like that, that could be, really expose a lot of what's been going on here. A lot of what we've already seen exposed by the Horowitz report and some of his hearings. I won't play any of the clips just because Mr. Flory spent a lot of time on the FISA and Horowitz material yesterday, but he, you know, while all the big impeachment hearings were going on, he had a lot of very interesting things to say over in the Senate, and he was talking about how, you know, the media's really zoomed in on this. Well, we didn't find any bias. And he made a lot of statements that kind of clarified, well, you know, by saying that, we mean nobody came out and said, yes, I am biased. I did this because I am biased. But actually, he talked about there was a lot of evidence for bias and that, you know, basically, he's at a loss to explain some of these things that happened any other way apart from some institutional bias. And maybe Mr. Flory will get into some of those clips tomorrow. But it will be interesting to see, as I said, to see how this plays out once it moves into the Senate, if the Democrats allow this to move into the Senate. And maybe that's another reason why Ms. Pelosi is threatening to hold it up. That this is a last-ditch attempt to stop that moving on to the Senate where there could be a lot of wrongdoing exposed. I wanted to mention another news story from the US. I think this is also from yesterday. I'll explain why this caught my eye first, because it's maybe not one of the typical news stories that we talk about. But several years ago, I gave a program and I spent the first 5 minutes or so ranting about my dishwasher and about how it took 4 hours or something like that on its default cycle, and how appliances have all gotten worse and worse over the years. I was going on about that. And then after that program, when I would go and I would meet listeners to our show, the most commonly cited program that they brought up was that one. You know, they'd say, oh, I enjoyed your dishwasher program. I don't think anyone else ever mentioned any other program that I did, or it was much more rare. If somebody mentioned a program that I did, it was always the dishwasher program. Now, yeah, I was doing it to make a serious point on just how much EU regulations have impacted every facet of British life. And there are consequences of that much more severe than having your dishwasher take a long time. But it made me happy yesterday when Mr. Trump had some of the same concerns. I'm not the only one talking about regulations on dishwashers. So this is a speech that Mr. Trump made talking about some similar things. And I think this is from a campaign rally. If it's not yesterday, it was certainly very recent.
Sinks, showers, all of this stuff. I did a lot of it. No water comes out. You have areas where there's so much water, you don't know what to do with it. You turn on the shower, you're not allowed to have any water anymore. I mean, we do a lot of it. Dishwashers, we did the dishwasher, right? You press it. Remember the dishwasher? You'd press it, boom, there'd be like an explosion. 5 minutes later, you open it up, the steam pours out, the dishes. Now you press it 12 times. Women tell me, again, you know, they give you 4 drops of water. And they're in places where there's so much water, they don't know what to do with it.
Well, like I said, I enjoyed the fact that he made this point. But I think there is, again, once again, a serious point around this, where both Britain and America are now, where I think we're on the same trajectory, on the same trend when it comes to a lot of these regulations. Now that Britain's leaving the EU, it looks like, and Mr. Johnson and his government, just even the last few days, have made some steps that make it look like they're going to seriously roll back a lot of these regulations. And that's been one of the many remarkable features about Mr. Trump's presidency, one that's not been talked about so much. But he's also doing a lot to roll back regulations. But PJ Media talked about this video, and they noticed how in 1978, the average dishwasher only took an hour to wash, but by 2014, it had increased to between 2 and 3 hours. And they talked about how it comes from regulation. I think it was the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, talked about to help compensate for the negative impacts on cleaning performance associated with decreasing water use and water temperature. Manufacturers will typically increase the cycle time. So all of these regulations are coming on. They make things take longer. It's maddening in some cases because they make things worse. You know, your tumble dryer does not dry as effectively as it used to. So you end up having to run it through 2 cycles, which is now worse for the environment than it was back when they didn't have the environmental regulations. And this PJ Media piece pointed out that the DOE, I guess that's probably the Department for Environment, normally DOE, I'm used to that standing for the Duke of Edinburgh, but I doubt that's what it's talking about in this case. But under Mr. Obama, they were actually considering putting even more strict regulations on dishwashers and the like. And they ended up pulling back from that at the moment, but they point out that the Democrats in 2020 would probably revisit that. But we're seeing a complete change of course than we had under Mr. Obama now in the United States. In 2018, Mr. Trump's administration had the fewest new regulations since records began, or that records were first being kept back in the 1970s. And they wrote that Mr. Trump's deregulation strategy will actually make life better for most Americans in concrete ways. And we're seeing exactly the same trend for Britain now that we're leaving the EU as well. There's some events that show that Britain seems to be rolling back a lot of its regulation. For example, the Times of London had an article yesterday saying that Mr. Johnson was moving forwards with a plan that would allow British judges at any level to be able to overrule the European Court of Justice and European Union case law. Under Theresa May's deal that was being discussed before, then only the Supreme Court or the High Court of Justiciary in Scotland would be able to depart from EU case law. But Mr. Johnson wants to give any court, pretty much at any level, the ability to go against EU law, but to override EU law, to make British judges supreme to EU law. And that's going to do a whole lot to, if he goes forward with this, this is all still tentative. I think we'll see when he lays the bill out on Friday. But that's a very practical point to rolling back a lot of these different EU laws. Now, that's about more than just regulation. You know, all of these freedom-stifling bits of European law, when Europe cracks down on free speech, say, on the internet, it will give courts the ability, and even lower courts the ability, to say, no, you know, this is fundamentally incompatible with principles of freedom enshrined in British law. That will not stand. Now, then it may also introduce some complications, as you could have a whole lot of kind of laws in flux, but Britain leaving the European Union was always going to have some complications. It's something that's had a huge amount of power over our lives for several decades. But it's a very practical step to start to roll back European rule in Britain. But The Spectator had a very thoughtful article. I think it was from Peter Klepp, who works for the think tank Open Europe. So it was, you know, a bit technical, but one of those articles that's from an expert that knows what they're talking about, breaks it down, talking about Britain and regulation, and about how Britain and Europe are on very different paths now when it comes to regulation, and that how, no matter what Mr. Johnson wants, that Britain is probably going to end up as a low regulation kind of state outside of Europe's regulations. And I think that is what Mr. Johnson would want anyway. But he talks about the way that those in Europe are just full steam ahead right now to more and more and more regulation. He talks about the Dutch EU Commissioner Frans Timmermans, who, you know, he's pushing a so-called European Green Deal with all kinds of new EU initiatives for regulations, with more and more targets of all of these different types of areas of life, and then big spending plans there. It talks about how, well, if Britain, even under kind of a close to the EU plan, if they were to leave right now, they would be signed up to all European current regulation. And that would be a possibility. But even if Britain does that, well, Europe keeps updating the regulation in all of these areas, and often updating them in quite radical ways. And so he writes, if the UK rightly decides not to accept this update, this may well force it to give up part of its EU market access, something that would then have to be renegotiated. But he writes, to summarize, even if Boris opts for the softest of soft future relationship models, the EU's regulatory zeal is likely to drive the UK to diverge in terms of regulation, thereby truly becoming the competitor Angela Merkel fears. And so it would be that the EU would drive the UK towards becoming a Singapore on Thames, even in Singapore is not actually as deregulated as some assume. So because these laws would be updated, even if we subscribe to current EU regulation, we're probably not going to want to follow along with their updates. And so we'll end up breaking with that regulation entirely and ending up with a lot much lower regulatory environment. He writes that the regulatory competition resulting from all of this would not only benefit the UK, but he also writes that it is likely to put more pressure on the EU's regulatory machine. Having the UK as a big economy outside of Europe, outside of their regulatory reach, that's going to possibly slow down how much regulation they can put onto their own economies, how much they can regulate things like finance and the internet, even within Europe. And you can see how that could drive some animosity between Europe and the European and the UK, how that would make the EU more and more resentful of Britain. But it's something that can have some big impacts. He also writes, forget the EU budget or how the UK will manage to open more markets than the EU. The real benefit of Brexit will be to release from the burdensome Brussels regulatory machine. Just as Brussels is partly to blame for Brexit, it may ultimately drive the UK to a more regulatory divergence than would be the case otherwise. So he's saying, well, the big benefit economically from leaving the European Union is getting out from underneath all of these regulations, being able to set our own rules, making British dishwashers great again. And then you go to America and Mr. Trump is talking about making American dishwashers great again. And again, it's about a whole lot more than having functioning dishwashers. It's about the crushing burden that a lot of this regulation puts on companies. You know, George Friedman has made the point before where he's talked about how the EU is kind of jealous of Google and Facebook and all of these different American startups. Well, look, you go to you compare what it's like to start up a business in both the US and in the EU. You can start up a business in the US in your garage. Much, much more difficult to do that in the European Union because there's just so many bits of regulation that you've got to conform to. So it makes it so much easier for inventors, for innovators, for businesses to start up, for people to generate wealth when you are out from all of these burdensome regulations. So you could very well see a brief economic resurgence for both the UK and the US as we cut back on all of these regulations. As we change the way that we deal with business, setting business free and having this resurgence. Now, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard had a good point in The Telegraph yesterday. He had an article, the title was Global Rebound Could Help Trump Back to the White House Despite Systemic Risks. And he had a good technical analysis of the global economy. And his basic conclusion was that all the signs show that the economy is going to be doing very well, and doing very well all up to and including November 2020, and that will really help Mr. Trump. He said, my working assumption is that Donald Trump has enough economic momentum to retake the White House in November, for good or ill, depending on your view, but undoubtedly with huge consequences. But then he goes on to talk about that, well, yeah, there's a lot in the short term that does look very good for the world economy, but there are still massive long-term problems. He writes, the financial edifice is unstable, unsafe, and very late cycle. And then he concludes, we had better hope that QE, or quantitative easing, continues to blanket everything and hide all sins. We've got massive monetary sins, but we're covering it all up at the moment by printing massive amounts of money. And I think this is, you know, this is an interesting, it's an important thing to look at, and it really is a type of all of the problems facing Britain and America. Britain and America's governments are, you know, things are looking good in a lot of ways in the short term. They are taking some good decisions that are fundamentally going to improve things, like rolling back a lot of this burdensome regulation. But at the same time, there are some massive things that they're not dealing with that are going to cause huge long-term problems. I look at the debt that America has massive debt, Britain has massive debt. Britain's conservative government for the last 10 years, we've been in this era of kind of pretend austerity, where it suits all the different political parties to pretend that we're cutting back on the budget. You know, the Conservatives, that way they can pretend that they're being fiscally responsible and fixing the problems left from the previous Labour government's massive spending. It suits Labour to pretend that this is the case, because then they accuse the Conservatives of being hard-hearted and killing people by cutting back spending and not using all of their money to make society so much of a better place. But when you look at it, Britain hasn't had austerity. You know, the rate of the growth of government spending has been slowed from the massive expansion under Labour, but Britain is still borrowing money every year. Yep, not borrowing as much, but if you on your family budget were to say, I've really cut back, I've really got my finances under control, I'm not borrowing as much money to get through the year this year as I was 10 years ago, your finances are still not in very good shape. But that even kind of pretense of austerity is coming to an end now with Mr. Johnson, and he's unveiling a whole lot of massive, massive spending projects, and it looks like he's going to spend big time. We're seeing exactly the same approach under Mr. Trump, and he's kind of pushing the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates, to make it much easier to borrow money, to even have negative interest rates where you pay people basically to borrow money, really encouraging debt. And one, we've seen something this week and just over the last few months, though, that show that this massive debt is starting to have some real consequences. It's not something that has been talked about too much, and it's not something that necessarily affects our day-to-day lives, but we're starting to see bits of the economy break because the government is borrowing so much money. The Institute of International Finance, they were talking about the world economy. They said that global debt has reached mind-boggling levels. Now, that's not a term you normally hear from economists. It's normally all very technical. But mind-boggling. They're trying to wake people up as to how vast the debt all around the world is. But America is set to borrow pretty much $1 trillion a year, every year, just going on up and up and up and up forever. And I think everybody knows this kind of massive borrowing has massive consequences, but they're not immediate consequences, and so we just ignore it. But this part of the market and the financial system that looks like it's been starting to break is something called the repo market, which can sound technical. It's not really. It's basically the repo market is basically pawn shops or pawn brokers for banks, where banks need quick loans all the time, or other financial institutions, hedge funds, just short-term loans. And the repo market, or the repurchase market, provides short-term cash for these banks that need them. Basically, the bank in need of cash sells an asset, usually a treasury bond, but it can be other things, with an agreement to buy it back with interest the next day. So they go to another bank, we'll sell you this for $100. We'll agree to buy it back tomorrow for $101 because we just need some cash overnight. And this goes on all the time. Generally, around $1 trillion is loaned this way overnight on any given day. And the last time that there were big problems in this repo market was in 2008. And back then, well, that was a big sign that things were going wrong. Banks didn't want to lend to each other. Suddenly, banks started saying, well, actually, these things that you're selling us, these assets that you're selling in exchange for money, we're not sure they're as safe as you say they are. We're worried that we could end up just lending you the money and then finding out that we're holding on to a useless piece of paper. And also, we're not sure you're going to be able to pay us that money back the next day. We're kind of a little worried that you might go bankrupt overnight. So that was the repo market was a major part of what went wrong in 2008, as banks just stopped lending to each other. And the situation became very dangerous very quickly because this just pushes banks into insolvency if they just can't even borrow the money to pay their bills, and they're all kind of reliant on being able to borrow money. But in September, the repo market was back in trouble. The interest rate just spiked up to 10%. If you can look at a graph, and it almost just shoots straight up. And 10% is really high for this form of lending. It's meant to be perfectly, really safe overnight lending, kind of some of the lowest interest rates around, and yet it spiked up to 10%. Now, at the moment, unemployment is at record low in general, the stock market's at record high. So why is this kind of one indicator of financial crisis flashing red while all the other lights are green? Well, since September, the Federal Reserve, they've had to kind of step in and fix the repo market. They're now loaning out a lot of that money that other banks won't. They've spent around $300 billion since September, not all of that on the repo market, but a lot of that is money that they're just pouring and lending out because no one else is lending, and these banks need that money to function. On Monday this week, they injected nearly $90 billion in a single day. Not all of those were overnight repo loans, but they were all in this short-term lending market. The Financial Times wrote, the Fed has been flooding the system with cash in the form of short-term loans. So this is how they've had to step in and keep things going. This part of the market is broken. Now, why is the repo market broken? Well, back in October, Bloomberg wrote, plenty of factors help cause liquidity to dry up. But the one that's getting more attention is concerned that dealers are starting to choke on treasuries as the US government goes deeper into debt. They wrote that, simply put, there was too much new debt flooding the financial system and not enough money causing lenders to jack up repo rates. So these big banks were so busy lending money to the US government that they didn't have enough cash left to loan these other banks. And the way that US government debt auctions work is there's a certain number of banks that kind of by law have to buy up the debt at a reasonable rate, and then they sell that on to a wider audience. But there was so much of this debt coming up that fulfilling these obligations to buy this debt was just sucking up all of their available cash, so that they didn't have enough to loan out to other banks. And so you saw this spike in repo rates, and the Federal Reserve had to step in and fix things. Now, there are other factors in play as well. This September crunch, it came while a lot of firms needed cash to pay their tax bills. Then there's also regulations that have been introduced since 2008 that force banks to keep a certain minimum cash on hand. And they kind of blame that as playing a significant role. There's some online or among the kind of the market watching community that speculate that there's a big bank in trouble somewhere, and that the Federal Reserve is using this to quietly bail them out. So there's other things at play here, but that massive debt is certainly an important factor. And since the financial crisis back in 2008, the Federal Reserve has basically been creating money and then using that to buy U.S. debt. And it's become one of the biggest, if not the biggest, buyer of U.S. debt in that time. And in 2017, it began winding that down. So we're only now starting to look at what it looks like when the Federal Reserve, basically one part of the government, isn't printing money and loaning it to the other part. That's what's kept us going so far. But now we're starting to see what happens without that. And already, just 2 years into this winding down, problems are emerging. And so now, with the Federal Reserve stepping in to prop up the repo market, they're basically back in the business of creating money and lending it to the US government, just now in a more roundabout way. Now, this doesn't mean that America's going to go bust tomorrow or Britain's going to go bust tomorrow, but they are some of the first concrete signs that our addiction to debt is causing major structural problems in the economy. And the Federal Reserve, I think for the repo market, you know, they will be able to compensate for now by basically, you know, just printing out this extra money, loaning it out themselves. And in some ways already managing the repo market has kind of already become the new normal. But that's not sustainable. You know, more and more structural problems are going to crop up. The Federal Reserve is going to end up fixing one problem after another, and maybe it will succeed at fixing some of those problems. But they can't stop the crash that's going to come from an economy that borrows $1 trillion a year, even when times are good. You know, just the fact that that's unsustainable should be common sense. Now, we've been warning about a financial collapse for a long, long time. Mr. Armstrong, for example, he wrote back in 1984 that a banking collapse in the United States, that it would have major consequences abroad, not just at home. He wrote that it could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power, larger than either the Soviet Union or the US. And he was basing those prophecies on, that forecast on Bible prophecy in the book of Revelation describes as the sudden revival of a power in Europe that's hostile to the US. Revelation chapter 18, it describes the vast wealth that its merchants acquire, that they take over the global trading system. And you can read that kind of in detail in all the different things that they trade. And the implosion of America's financial system, well, yeah, that could easily pave the way for this economic revolution, for this rise of this new financial power that dominates a new financial system. And the Bible also confirms that our spending practices are unsustainable. Psalm 37 verse 12 said, the wicked borrows and cannot pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. So borrowing money the way America's doing, the way Britain's doing it, the Bible says that's wicked behavior. That it never ends well. Now, the Bible also forecasts a real solution. It's not just a tweaking of interest rates. You know, the smartest men in finance and all of these different experts, they've not been able to come up with a working solution in our current system. It needs something new. And so soon, God is going to establish a fair, stable, prosperous financial system on earth. And you can read more about that system, what that's going to look like, in our free booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, what it will be like. And you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. If you just go up to the top of the library section at the top right there and you click down to the to our books and booklets, you should be able to find that. If you can't, you can always just shoot us an email at td@kpcg.fm. We'd be happy to send you a link or send you a free copy of that booklet. But as I said, this kind of economic story, it's really the resurgence that we're seeing in Britain and America in a nutshell. Things look great in the short term. And there are, like I said, both Britain and America, they are addressing some genuine economic problems. But at the same time, there are some massive structural problems, some huge things that we're doing wrong, like this huge debt that we're not even coming close to confronting, that we're actually making worse, that mean that this resurgence cannot last. You know, that's true in the financial sense for the financial markets, for our economies, but it's true for the whole nation as well. I mean, there are some good things that our governments are doing. There are some genuine problems, even in society, that they're confronting. But there are some of these massive problems, the massive sin that goes on in both our nations that's right at the heart of a lot of these problems. Well, it's not addressing a lot of those. In some cases, it's making those problems worse. And so, you know, we need to confront those fundamental problems. And ultimately, we need God's help in confronting those fundamental problems. That is how you have not just a temporary resurgence, but a permanent resurgence. And if we don't listen now, well, you know, God's going to bring that about in The Wonderful World Tomorrow. And that booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow booklet, talks about how he will do that and how that permanent resurgence will come. Well, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about some of the latest news from just this morning here in the UK.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man, and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. Well, earlier today, Britain had its state opening of Parliament. The Queen reads a speech prepared for her by the new government that sets out the new government's agenda. This whole ceremony contains one of my favourite weird little traditions where Black Rod, one of the officials, they go to summon the Commons to come and listen to the Queen in the House of Lords. And so this person, I think typically it's been a man, it's a woman at the moment, but as Black Rod walks to the House of Commons to go summon them, she always has the door slammed in her face. And that's just tradition to emphasize Parliament's independence. And then she knocks on the door and goes and calls Parliament. It just always amused me to watch them. You know, somebody's always there looking out. All right, she's nearly here. Slam. I mean, another interesting tidbit, we now have a new speaker, who is Speaker of the House of Commons, replacing John Bercow, and he set himself up as a traditionalist, you know, and he said he as opposed to what Mr. Bercow does, he is going to be a much more you know, stickler for just tradition and what the British constitution and rules say. And so he said, well, he would wear the speaker's wig on occasions, and especially on big, important occasions, this thing that used to be part of the speaker's wardrobe, but the traditionalists threw it out. But he didn't wear it today. And people have been asking, well, why haven't you been wearing the speaker's wig? And he said he can't find it. Apparently, it's not been used for so long that nobody knows where it is now. And again, I find the idea that the speaker's wig is stuck somewhere down the back of a couch in the House of Commons amusing. I mean, it does show, I mean, it illustrates in some ways what I want to talk about a bit in this half, that this move away from tradition that we have been seeing, that's been reversed to a certain extent in the UK. But anyway, they laid out all of their agenda now for the next parliament, for the next few years. And I mean, there's just been a little news coverage of that. It just happened an hour or two before we went on air. A lot of people are talking about how ambitious it is, how that it is just a one of the biggest, most packed Queen speeches that people have seen for a long, long time. And yeah, they want to get a lot done. They want to spend a lot. I mentioned that in the first half. They want to spend a lot more on the National Health Service. They want to spend a lot more to give people care inside their homes for when they get sick. They want to help first-time buyers on the housing ladder. There's a lot of infrastructure spending. Get Brexit done, of course, the first priority. On that, they also want to get rid of things like the Fixed Term Parliament Act and look at some of the changes that were made to Britain's constitution and way of doing government over the last 5-10 years and reversing some of those negative ones. But a new government, and those were its priorities. And George Friedman, I thought this week, had some very interesting thoughts on this new government. And I think his thoughts apply very directly to the United States as well. And he talks about, I guess he's either, you know, in the UK or just been visiting the UK, and he talks about coming into the UK after the election and just talking to his taxi driver. And in the past, I've kind of felt like George Friedman, as smart as he is, doesn't get Brexit. He's kind of talked about it more in terms of, well, Britain made a military alliance with Europe and bet its future over there, and that's what Brexit is about, and it's a choice between, well, do we want to ally with Europe or with America? But that doesn't really get to the heart of why Britain voted to leave the European Union. And I think he gets it now, though, reading what he wrote about this conversation with a taxi driver, and he makes some really good points. And he talked about how they talked about Brexit, and he talked about how he voted for the Conservatives because of how much he loathed what he called the posh in London. And there he talked about their hatred for England while enriching themselves shamelessly and despising anyone who doesn't worship as they worship. And Friedman writes, by worship, he was referring not to religion, but to their belief that Britain is corrupt and demands ruthless reform. He particularly was enraged by that the playing of Rule Britannia was seen by the posh left as disgraceful, because it paid homage to an evil that Britain ought to apologize for over and over, the British Empire. The loss of empire didn't bother him. What bothered him was that the posh left was unwilling to respect that whatever faults Britain might have had, Britain was a great moment in human history, and he, as a British subject and as a Scotsman, was not prepared to be ashamed of it. What happened in Britain is something that can be seen elsewhere. The left wing has become the party of well-educated, well-to-do elites, and the Conservatives have become the party of the workers. And it's a good point that he makes about that this whole attitude towards history is fundamentally wrapped into this issue of Brexit. And you know, just to show as well that this point about Rule Britannia being looked down upon, this is not just something that this one taxi driver came up with. This actually came up on Good Morning Britain, and I'll let you listen to the exchange or watch on the YouTube stream of what they talked about when it came up on that TV program.
Try and explain to me why Rule Britannia is offensive. Well, I mean, the song was written in, you know, the middle of the 1700s, and that was when Britain was fully partaking in the slave trade. So to have lyrics like "Rule Britannia" and saying Britons will never, never, never be slaves while then fully participating in slavery in 2019, I find that completely out of date.
So you would ban it too, would you?
Yeah, I don't think that it should... Well, banning it completely, if people want to kind of sing it in their own private homes...
You'd ban it from the airways. We'd never play it in public again.
I don't think that we should be playing it and singing it on things like...
One of the greatest patriotic anthems this nation
has ever had. Why is it patriotic, though? Why is it...
Because it stirs the soul and it reminds us... It reminds the fact we're a great country.
What I think is that it reminds of us colonial rule.
You realise that the ones who survived the war all sing that song proudly, do you?
Singing proudly, though, to say, rule Britannia.
Yeah, we did rule. We won the world wars.
And that's the message that some of these people are putting out. And it's still... Rule Britannia was written during the... She said mid-18th century or mid-17th century. It was written during the War of Jenkins's Ear, which has got to be one of the best-named wars in history. I don't know if anybody's keeping a tab on that. But they pointed out on this show that this is part of a... this whole movement of a lot of things that people like George Friedman's Taxi Driver would typically be proud of, and the left trying to turn around and say, well, no, they're evil, they're racist. Here's what Piers Morgan had to say about that in the same show.
Now, what we've been seeing recently is we've been seeing, Joanna, a sort of creeping revisionist view of stuff that we have traditionally celebrated as a nation. Winston Churchill is now the devil for a lot of young people, right? They're encouraged to believe he was a force for evil, the guy that basically single-handedly rallied this country to win a world war. Rule Britannia, which has been this anthem of celebration of all great things of this country, which we sing proudly as a nation. When we remember, actually, that those who gave the sacrifice, that now has to go too, because Lily Allen has decided.
So, you know, that's the message that has been sent by a lot of these quote-unquote posh in London. But going back to this Friedman article, he writes, the European Union question is mixed in with this. The posh, I will use that name for them, supported EU membership eagerly. And he talks about how they benefited from that financially, working in politics and the media and finance and all of these areas. But then he also writes, there's another aspect of this he did not mention. If one of the things you wish to do is to take ownership of British history and deny the British the right to admire the greatness and forgive themselves what harm they did, then the EU is the perfect vehicle. In announcing and trying to impose a European identity, devaluing one's own nation, the EU gave the posh a powerful tool with which to subordinate the brilliant, dark, and beloved history of Britain. He talks about it, well, he says it's that it's hard to understand this class's desire to redefine Britain's recollection of the past. And, well, he just goes on to talk about that in that way. But it's really interesting, I thought, and a great point where he ties in Britain's European Union membership with this view of the history and this push by the elites to downplay Britain's history. And like you said, you know, it's kind of hard to understand this class's desire to redefine Britain's recollection of the past. I mean, he doesn't even fully understand, well, why they would even want to do that. But that being in the European Union that really does try to push this very common European view of history and downplay national identities, and especially Britain's national identity, because so much of Britain's history has been fighting against powers that have wanted to take over and unify Europe. Now, you see this both in America and in Britain. Britain, they're using the European Union, but in America, it's done in a lot of ways through some of these colleges and things like that, where they're trying to attack the history of Britain and America. And this did play a big role in the election. You can kind of, I think it's interesting, if you look at the polls last week for the election, and those Labour strongholds that voted for Brexit, those were the places that switched to vote for the Conservatives. So Brexit was obviously important. But then if you look at when they've subsequently done opinion polling and asked people, well, you know, why? Why did you've been a lifelong Labour member. Why did you vote for Boris Johnson and the Conservatives and not Jeremy Corbyn and Labour? Brexit overall wasn't the top issue that they cited. You know, instead, they talked about being worried about Jeremy Corbyn on national security, on anti-Semitism. They brought up the way that he always seemed to hate this country and always side with Britain's enemies, whether it's the IRA terrorists in Ireland, to the Hamas terrorists in the Middle East, to Vladimir Putin in Russia. You know, he would always side with Britain's enemies. It's all related to the same view of history. They fundamentally couldn't support a party who had this negative view of history, of Britain's history, who were ashamed, in Jeremy Corbyn's case, I think, not just of the history, but of the present as well, and just ashamed of Britain. And that Britain's European Union membership ties right in that. It's by a class of people that believe that Britain's heritage is fundamentally flawed and wrong and ought to be subsumed into this much larger European ideal. That Britain itself, in some of these cases of these Euro-federalists of the more extreme type, that Britain itself should be abolished and just absorbed into this European superstate. It comes from a dislike of Britain's identity and Britain's history. And you see it then not just in their push for European Union membership, but in all of these statements saying, well, okay, well, Brexit should be bad. I mean, Rule Britannia should be banned. I think it's interesting as well. I guess Lily Allen, some singer or something, was the one that was talking about Rule Britannia back in November. She has since made the headlines by saying things like, well, everybody who voted for Brexit or for Boris Johnson is racist. Something along those lines. I don't think I read the article. I just saw some headlines. So you've got this situation where it's the same people saying, well, Britain's history, you know, evil, all racist, cannot be proud of that. If you're proud of that, you're racist. And if you don't want to join the European Union, you are racist. But these points that Mr. Friedman made, it reminded me of an article that then Trumpet columnist Robert Morley wrote about 10 years ago now, called The Inspiring History Britain Should Never Forget. And he began that article writing, no nation outside of ancient Israel has experienced more cases of divine inspiration than Great Britain. Just try to find one, and not just little everyday miracles either, although there have been plenty of those too, but history-altering events, events that have no explanation but that of divine intervention, miracles without which the nation would have ceased to exist. Britain is turning its back on those miracles. Its people have forgotten. Its politicians are signing away the sovereignty of a nation that is only independent and free today because of those many miracles. And I don't have too much time to go through those, but he just goes through event after event after event in history of miracles in Britain. You know, the Spanish Armada, where the wind blew the Spanish away. He has several others. Then going down into Waterloo, where rain the night before the battle meant the British army could successfully retreat, be in a position to link up with the Prussian or the German army and defeat Napoleon the next day. And that rain changed the history of the world. That's something you can look, modern historians acknowledge the role of the rain the night before the Battle of Waterloo. There's so much more beyond that, so much more in World War I, World War II. We had a whole program where we talked about the miracle of D-Day and just those many miracles going on there. Mr. Morley wrote, no modern nation has as many life-preserving miracles as Great Britain. British history is filled with irrefutable examples of God-given deliverance and preservation. It should be so clear that even the blind can't help but see. Yet today, British politicians turn their back on that history and the countless miracles that preserved the nation's freedom. And then he goes on to talk about the European Union. Again, he ties in this turning its back on British history and wanting to join the European Union. He talked away about how in 2007 the nation signed the Lisbon Treaty, signing away its British sovereignty without even allowing a vote on the issue. And he talked about how Britain's passed more and more powers over to the European Union, or had at that point. And he asked, will Britain ever remember its history? The British people are now entering the most critical phase in their history, stripped of empire, devoid of much of its material power, plagued by economic problems. Its place as a great power lost. Britain, instead of looking to the God who miraculously ensured its freedom so many times throughout history, is looking to Europe for safety and security. And he talks about, again, some of those miracles and says, wake up, Britain. Remember your history. And I think if you look at Brexit, in a small extent, that is happening. Not to the extent that it needs to, but outside of the posh, liberal, educated elite, there is still a pride in Britain's history and an understanding of some of Britain's history. And that is behind some of that Brexit vote. Now, they need to remember more. I've not heard anybody talking about these miracles. They're remembering some of the good points in Britain history. They're remembering that there are things to be proud of. You know, that Britannia ruling the waves led to the abolition of the slave trade. But they're neglecting. They're not looking back at the miracles. And what Britain needs, yes, there's been some benefit from looking back at history. What Britain needs now is more looking back at history. Looking back and seeing not just the events and the achievements to be proud of, but God's role in that history. How time and time again the nation was in peril and God worked miracles to save Britain. You know, that's the solution for Britain. That's the real solution for America as well. That's why Britain and America really do need to dig even deeper into that history. Instead, the intellectuals are getting rid of it, trying to say it's shameful. There, like I said, there's some historical knowledge still, but they need to be digging deeper because it points back to those miracles and ultimately it points back to God. Now, that's about all I've got time for. If you want to read more about those miracles and those concrete proofs of miracles, you can go and read Mr. Morley's article, The Inspiring History Britain Should Never Forget. You can type that into Google or search for it on our Trumpet website. You should be able to find that. I believe Mr. Stephen Fly will be back in the hot seat or the hot stand, I guess, here tomorrow on KPCG on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 on the FM dial. If you have any comments, you can shoot us an email at td@kpcg.fm.